You know, for a long time, I meant to try Pete's Coffee, but just never gave it a chance. But ever since I did, I have a hard time settling on anything less.
And there's something to say about a coffee company with such rich history and devotion to bring you that perfect brew.
Since Alfred Pete opened his first coffee bar in 1966, Pete's has selectively sourced the finest beans in the world, carefully calibrating each roast by hand and crafting each beverage with the utmost care.
Pete's aims to produce fresh from the roaster's coffee delivered directly to your door, sourcing the top 1% of coffee beans, roasted by hand to unlock each bean's potential, and delivering it to you fresh to bring you the perfect cup.
With over 30 flavor varieties in both gourmet coffees and teas, like Vietnam Lotus Bold, Major Dickinson's Blend, and Arabian Mocha Java, you are sure to find the right flavor to start your day. And they even come in K-Cups for those of you who live life on the go.
Check out all the varieties of Pete's has to offer by following the link in the show notes below.
And starting August 30th, you can take advantage of their Labor Day sale and get yourself 20% off anything on their site by using promo code LABORDAY20 at checkout. This offer is valid through September 5th. That's promo code LABORDAY20 at checkout for 20% off your purchase this Labor Day.
But why not do one better? Use promo code NEWSUB30 at checkout and you get yourself 30% off of a new subscription to Pete's Coffee. That's right. All the delicious coffee you could want delivered right to your door each and every month without you ever having to worry about running low. What more could you ever need? That's promo code NEWSUB30 for 30% off your subscription.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Grindhouse, where we drink coffee, talk about movies. My name is Leah Diana, and today, with my boyfriend and co-host, Sean Tatro, we will be winding back the reels to 1986. You remind me of the babe.
What babe?
The babe with the power.
What power?
The power of voodoo.
Hoodoo.
You do.
Do what?
Remind me of the babe. In the labyrinth! Let's get into it.
TriStar Pictures announces the collaboration of three extraordinary talents. Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets and Dark Crystal.
Where you go with a head like that?
George Lucas, creator of the Star Wars saga. And one of the most innovative forces in modern entertainment, David Bowie. Together, they will take you into a dazzling world of fantasy and adventure.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
A world where anything seems possible, and nothing is what it seems.
Everything I've done for you. I move the stars for no one.
The world of Labyrinth.
Spread the word, you dirty cocksuckers. Tell all your grave robbing friends of what's the matter of the city now!
The nightmare of insane murder.
From the depths of hell.
Monster, the angel of death.
Only at the Grindhouse.
I love this movie. I love this movie. And it's weird why I love this movie. I distinctly remember being about maybe 7, 8, 9 years old. I don't remember. but it was prior to my brother being born. And I remember seeing an advertisement on the Disney Channel, you know, the early Disney Channel, where they were playing this movie, but it was coming on at 7 p.m. And I had to ask my parents to stay up to watch this movie because I wouldn't go to bed till 9, and that was way past my bedtime. I don't remember a lot from when I was younger. I have a really bad memory. But I distinctly remember every part of this movie and how it made me feel at that young of an age. And rewatching it back now made me realize just how impactful this movie was, being the only child about ready to have siblings. Like, everything I owned was now going to be like somebody else, like I'll have to share, I'll have to learn all these new skills. And I didn't realize how much I related to Sarah until this moment at like the 5 millionth viewing of this movie. But this movie shaped how I grew up from being an only child to having siblings. It's kind of funny, but not, because it's like, how come you didn't see that? You know, you're going to be, as of today when you guys are listening, 37 years old. Ugh, I'm old. And this movie is 36 years old.
Yeah, I think this was one that, I think this one impacted a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think maybe if they didn't understand the meanings behind it when they first saw it, or like, I can tell you, I never really understood the plot. It was the visual spectacle that captivated me.
Yeah.
And I think this, combined with all of the practical effects and stuff that I grew up watching, this was one of those movies that like really made me fall in love with puppetry.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, whenever I see a physical like puppet effect of any kind in a movie, it gives me that warm, nostalgic feeling. And I think movies like this, Dark Crystal, like they have a lot to do with that, because as a child, you're going to be shown all these like kid-friendly movies. You'll be shown The Muppets and even some Disney works that aren't animated will generally have like puppets and practical things like that to kind of capture the imagination. Yeah, I think this is definitely one that influenced me, whether I knew it or not.
And I think this was one of like the really big first Disney movies. Like, I didn't watch a lot of like those, like growing up, like the movies that can come to mind is like All Dogs Go to Heaven, Rock-a-Doodle-Doo, The Secret of Nim. I didn't watch those. I watched Disney shows. I remember coming home from school and watching Alice in Wonderland and all those other shows. I watched Nickelodeon. I watched Clarissa Explains It All and all those crazy shows back in the 90s. But this is the first movie where I was like drawn in. It's a simple movie. It's a simple film, but it's so mysterious and so fantastical to me that I wanted to be Sarah growing up. I wanted that, you know, that ideal, that bedroom with all those wonderful, beautiful things and that beautiful dress and, you know, to be like that actress. And I really like realize how much I wanted to be fucking Sarah Williams, you know? Is it William or Williams? I think it's Williams.
I honestly have never.
It says it on all the pictures of her mom.
Oh.
So there's a lot of backstory to all of this. And I actually have fun facts I don't have to look at my phone for, which is kind of funny.
Before we get into any of that, I do want to say like that's one of my major notations here. And I didn't actually make the note until like the end of the movie. But one of the things about this movie that I always found myself wishing for more of was depth in the characters.
Yeah.
And like I've always, like mainly Jareth, like I've always wanted to know more, to learn more about all of them. Like the only person they really even try to focus on is Sarah. And I'm fine with that because it's her story. But at the same time, like, I just yearn to know more about where these characters came from, like the depth of them, like what their motivations are.
You know you can, right?
I know I can, but like in terms of this film, like I'm only trying to like focus on this specific story. But at the same time as like wanting to know more of that, there's a simplicity to it that I really enjoy because it allows your imagination to run wild and kind of fill in the gaps. But as you kind of made this point a moment ago, but there's a lot of detail physically throughout the movie that you can pick up on and kind of clue you into certain things about these characters. And like, for God's sake, the entire story is really shown to you within Sarah's bedroom.
Yeah.
The entire plot is there if you look for the...
If you pay attention to every single thing in that bedroom, it is all there. Jareth is there. The dress is there. The labyrinth there. The story, the actual play of the labyrinth is there. All the characters. Everything she goes through is in that room. Which, if you deep dive, and a lot of people have deep dive for meanings, because people look for meanings in everything. They think this is, like, things that I've seen is, this is a deep dive into Sarah's subconscious to grow up, because she realizes that she's supposed to be 15, 16, 17 in this movie. And she's supposed to be this very whimsical, childlike character that her mind forces her to grow up very quickly. And by the end, you see where this change is made. But she still is like, I'm not going to let go of everything, but I do have to move on. And it's really like, really hits me pretty hard. Like how I feel like growing up, I had my parents, had my brother and sister when I was 8, 9 years old. And I feel like I had to grow up very quickly and help them. We didn't grow up with a lot of money. We did grow up poor. And I know my mom listens to this. My parents tried to do the best they could. But, you know, they needed help. And unfortunately, they had a child that was, you know, almost a decade older than these two kids. So I had to help. They worked a lot. And I mean a lot. I don't remember my dad ever being home. I remember my mom working a shit ton. I remember back in the 90s, nobody get mad at my parents, but back in the 90s, I went to a Catholic school. And I would walk home from Catholic school because my Catholic school was like literally right behind my house. And I would walk home and I would be home from 2, 3 o'clock to like 5, 6 o'clock. I had to learn how to peel potatoes, start dinner. You know, if my brother and sister, you know, were being babysat somewhere else, I had to take care of myself. And now being 7, 8, 9 years old, that's unheard of in this time. That's considered child neglect. Like, yeah. But back then, there was no other way for my parents to make ends meet. Like, I literally had to sit there and be like, okay, you've got to grow up. You've got to be a big girl. And to me, a big girl meant... you couldn't be like this. So when I watched this movie, I was like, oh my God, like I want to be Sarah. Now as an adult, you look around and I'm still that girl. I have all, like, this apartment doesn't really tell it. A lot of my stuff is still in storage because we don't have a very big place, but I'm still that little girl.
Yes. And I think that actually plays pretty heavily into the themes that I pick up on in this movie, at least watching it now. Like you, I grew up in very similar circumstances, maybe not to the extremes that you did, but like my parents both worked. My dad was almost never home. He usually worked like the mid shift, like so he'd come home around 5, 6 o'clock. My mom worked the day shift while we were at school. We weren't left alone a lot, but I think like watching them while I grew up kind of made me grow up faster. Like I started working immediately
at 14.
I think I was 16, and I quickly learned to, you know, start cooking for myself and taking care of myself and basically being independent and growing up very fast.
Yeah.
For me, especially, at least once you reach the end of this story, you kind of... it's very apparent that they're trying to tell you that this is a story about growing up. This is a story about accepting responsibility. This is a story that... it's about moving on in your life. However, you should never let go of what makes you you.
Yeah.
And you should always at least try to hold on to some small part of that imagination, which is, I feel, what Sarah does at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
But I think we've dove ahead of ourselves here.
This movie has a lot. You wouldn't think a simple puppet movie for kids would be so in-depth. But when I say that this movie molded children from the 80s, it really did. I don't know anyone who hates this movie. I don't know anyone who wasn't introduced to David Bowie through this movie.
If you hate this movie, you're soulless.
But if people that hate this movie also do not understand the meaning behind this movie, Jim Henson could have been like, oh, I just want to make a simple movie about a girl rescuing her brother. And I've overanalyzed this movie with friends. Why? My voice is cracking. This is how this movie makes me emotional, okay? Like, this movie shaped who I became as a teenager and as an adult now. Like, it is uncanny what this movie really meant to me as a kid. And even as an adult, I only watch this movie maybe once or twice a year. I never wanted to overdo this movie. There are movies I put it, Lord of the Rings. I watch Lord of the Rings either once or twice a year. This movie, I don't, because I never want to get sick of this movie. I have it on tape, DVD, Blu-ray. And to me, if there's a new release, I'll buy it. I don't care. I have the pop figures. I have stuffed animals for this. I had slippers at one point. I don't know what happened to those. They're gone. Friend of mine bought me Labyrinth tarot cards for Christmas, which are beautiful. And it's one of those things that, like, I forget about this movie and then you're reminded and you're like, oh yeah, huh. But anyways, let's stop over analyzing ourselves with this film.
Actually
talk about it.
So this week we watched Jim Henson's Labyrinth. This film is... The story came from Jim Henson and Dennis Lee. It's directed by Jim Henson off of a screenplay by Terry Jones. The movie stars David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. It was originally released June 27th, 1986. It was made on a budget of $25 million, and it brought in a box office return of $12.9 million. So this was actually a commercial failure by a monumental...
Which means it's going to be a cult classic.
Oh, absolutely.
I just realized when you said it was written by Terry Jones, I'm like, Terry Jones, I know that name. Monty Python, Flying Circus.
Yes.
Holy shit.
Terry Jones was... He worked a lot with the Monty Python crew on a variety of their films and series.
Hang on, sorry. I just derailed you. I clicked on Jennifer Connelly because, you know, I followed pretty much her career. Do you know who her husband is?
No.
Vision.
No shit.
Her husband is Paul Bettany. They've been married since 2003.
That's awesome.
And they have 4 children together. Wow.
God damn.
3 children, I'm sorry. 3. Huh. I'm going to stop putting the... Nope, we're putting Wikipedia down. Continue, I'm sorry.
So this film went on to have such a following that it actually, as you sort of mentioned, or you alluded to at the very least, that it was later given a sequel, Return to the Labyrinth. Came out between 2006 and 2010, but it's a comic book series.
It's a manga series. I own 2 or 3 of them. Yeah.
And from what I've heard, it is a really cool extension to the story.
It follows Toby. Sarah's grown up. Sarah has moved on. And it's Jareth getting a hold of Toby saying, I need a successor. And it follows how Toby kind of thought that whole thing was just a dream. And even Sarah was like, oh, you know, it never happened. It never really happened. But once Jareth contacts Toby and says, I need a successor, that's when Sarah opens up to her brother. And it really goes into the plots where, and I think, I'm not 100% sure, so people can correct me, where Jareth was in love with Sarah. And you can see David Bowie does have a very good range of emotions in his face, to where people think that Jareth was falling in love with Sarah. And I really don't think that's the case. I have always, in my mind, thought that Jareth
was in love with Sarah's mother. And he always thought that Sarah was the daughter he could never have because Sarah is human. So I've always thought that he saw Sarah more as a daughter, as he would love to raise her. He would love to. I never really liked the whole he's in love with her thing. It's very typical fantasy. That's why in my mind, I've always thought that Jareth looked at her as the daughter I would never have. I would love to care for her. I would love to keep her safe. Give her everything she's ever wanted, because that's all she wants.
Now, does this come from, like, the comic
series? No, this is my personal. Like, I've always thought of. But people think that Jareth is in love with Sarah. That's what the whole thing.
That I can understand.
Yeah.
But where does the mother factor
that's
in?
That's my personal opinion.
Reaching on that one?
That's what I've always thought of.
Okay.
I've always thought that Jareth was in love with Sarah's mother and has watched her grow up. That's why the owl is always watching Sarah. I didn't really like the whole Sarah and Jareth fall in love plot because she's like 15, 16 and he's like,
God knows how old.
Yeah. I was like, that's a little creepy. But fantasy, you know, whatever.
Yes. Something I would like to mention before we get too far, because this answers a question that you had while we were watching the movie.
Mm.
So Labyrinth is a musical fantasy film, as I said, directed by Jim Henson, with George Lucas as executive producer.
So technically,
ILM did do the effects for this.
And you and I just finished watching Light and Magic, which is the documentary behind ILM. And Jesus Christ, people, watch that fucking documentary. I was blown away. Okay, I have been mad at George Lucas for the sequels. 4 years. 4 years. Yes, I'm a hater of the, the prequels. I've never liked them. They've always made me unhappy. But after watching Light and Magic, I realize George thought that it was the right time to do those movies. He should have waited just a little bit longer. Because the visions and everything that he had for those movies, if he would have waited 5 more years, it would have been even more incredible.
Yeah. They are now doing his original vision for what they would have been with stuff like The Mandalorian.
Yes.
And, like, in that documentary, you even get to see him, like, on the set of Mandalorian being like, this is what I wanted
30 years ago. And you're just sitting there like, this is what you thought of 30 years ago. Guys, you have to thank George Lucas for the advancement computer graphics in movies. You have to thank him for the advancement of practical magic in movies. You have to thank his team for the creation of Adobe Photoshop. I didn't know this. John Knoll, who worked for ILM, and his brother created Adobe Photoshop. Nothing in the film industry, in the photo industry, nothing in the advancements of graphic design or video design would have been possible without George Lucas. What the fuck, George?
It's funny because, like, almost nobody knows that.
I lost my shit when I found half this out.
I'm very glad that they covered that stuff in that series, because now maybe people, like, I think George Lucas made some mistakes, but you can't discredit what he did to push the envelope.
His entire team on the original Star Wars, A New Hope, his entire team created cameras, created that motion cap, created this stuff for Star Wars. And here I am, like, watching this thinking Star Wars was just a cool space fantasy movie. No. George Lucas literally rewrote how everything was made for 3 decades. And if it wasn't just solely George Lucas, it was the team that he created. It was the people he surrounded himself with. And he made sure that, oh, I created ILM for myself, but my friends can use it. Like Steven Spielberg. Like, he was friends with Francis Ford Coppola. Didn't know that. Who else was he friends with? James Cameron, who, you know, all of his shit. I'm like, what the... I was blown away by how great that documentary was. Here I am sitting here going, oh, okay, it's just going to be a lighthearted documentary about how, you know, Star Wars was made. Star Wars was the first 2 episodes. Guys, Pixar was created by George Lucas's people. And then he sold them to Apple. And then Apple sold it to Disney. We wouldn't have Pixar if it wasn't for George Lucas. I really wish we still had video, because I was sitting here when I found that out. I looked at him and went, are you fucking kidding me? I've hated George Lucas for the prequels since they came out. No, since Attack of the Clones, the second movie. I saw that in theater and I was very disappointed. 20 years later, I'm like, what the fuck, George?
And this movie was developed during
the height.
During the building of ILM. So, like, technically, ILM didn't work on this movie, but no. The people who were ILM did.
Yes, because you can see, and I don't know, I know that Philip Tippett, he was more of a stop-motion animator. But you had the green screen scene with the Chili Gang, which I've always like, oh, this is terrible CG. But then you're sitting here going, this is 1986. This was probably remarkable for 1986. And I'm like, holy shit, this movie's 36 years old.
Yeah, this movie is, it's an absolute visual spectacle. And it's a treasure trove of puppetry. Coming from Jim Henson, that's not a surprise.
There is more puppets than there are live actors. There are 4 live actors. The dad, the stepmom, David Bowie, and Jennifer Connelly.
Yes. And
that's it.
Every...
Oh, I can't forget Toby, whose real name is actually Toby.
And every scene, every single scene showcases puppetry in some form. It's kind of astonishing. Like, even, I think even in the Muppet movies, they cut away from puppets at some point.
The one puppet that absolutely blows my mind every time is the dude walking around with the bird on his head. That is a person in that costume who is puppeting one hand, mouthing with one hand, and then there is a control in that hand for him to step away and then control the mouth of the little guy. So it's literally a 3-pulley system that this man has to do in this one costume. And it blows you away with how practical. Like, there is only one CG scene. Or no, there's 2. But this last CG scene is between David and Jennifer. And it's not really anything much more than we just have to superimpose them on a weird background. That's all that is. But
it's compositing.
Composite. Superimpose, composite. Whatever. Shall we get into the meat of this film?
And do you want to take us through the labyrinth?
So I've been wanting to ever since 1993. So I have no notes for this movie. None. 100% no notes. I know this movie like back of my hand. That's new. So the movie starts out with you're in a park and Sarah is acting a scene out of the end of the labyrinth in the park. And she can never remember her last line. There's an owl watching her and she has her dog Merlin with her. Clock chimes. It's 7:00. She was supposed to be home by 6 because her parents needed to leave to go on a date. Then ensues what I call the 1986 teenage angst of it's not fair.
Oh, God. So, yeah, that's something to note is that Jennifer Connelly's performance in this movie is so fucking overdramatic.
It's a perfect, perfect angsty teenage girl before we even knew what an angsty teenage girl was, really.
Yes.
She gets home and her stepmother is like, we rarely go out. She's like, you go out every weekend and we just ask you to babysit if you don't have plans. She was never asked me for my plans. So you can see where it's just like a very headstrong teenager and someone who just married into this family. She's just trying. You can tell. She's like, I don't know what to do. She treats me like the wicked stepmom. Like, what am I supposed to do? Kind of thing. And you only see the dad for like a split second, but you can tell that this is a family that was rocked with tragedy. They never tell you what happened to the mom. I don't know if she divorced. I don't know if she died. I think she passed away. I think that's what happened to her mom. She passes away. But it's just
something I noticed very early in these opening scenes is there's a lot of very noticeable ADR. For the dialogue.
Oh God. I hate you. I hate you. And her mouth doesn't move right then.
Yeah.
You're like,
and I kind of wonder if they just dubbed most of the movie.
I mean, it's possible because the one thing that I noticed is there was a lot of practical elements. And they probably had to use a lot of foam board and a lot of things that sound would have been really absorbed by. It wouldn't have been able to bounce off much. So I'm thinking that while they probably delivered the lines really well, maybe Jim was like, could have been stronger, let's redub it. And you notice a lot of the father, the stepmother, and Jennifer's lines in that house all are 80-yard, pretty much. Except until she gets to the point where she's like talking to the baby. Then you can tell that's actually her voice right there. It's not 80-yard. You get the shine on all the other movies. This is mine. This is my time to sparkle, baby.
You can have it. Take the floor.
I can't get on the floor. As of right now, okay, I'm still in my cast. We are 5 weeks into this. I get it off a week from Tuesday. I'm going to be so happy. And when you guys are listening to this, it's my birthday. So that's one of the reasons why we're doing this, because this is this movie. One day you and I are going to go into our top, what would we say, top 20 or top 50 movies?
I think it was top 50, 25 from each eventually.
So this is my number one. End all be all. This is number one. Spoiler alert. This is my number one, and I'll get into more of why it's my number one when we get to that discussion. But no, this is my number one, and my birthday fell on a release day for Grindhouse. We planned this one in February, guys. I looked at him and went, that goes in September 5th right now. And he was like, all right, okay. And this is probably why we messed up on the order of movies so many times.
Yeah.
Because we put this one in. So when you guys are listening to this, it is my birthday. I turned 37. I'm old lady. Got a couple more years till 40. And I still buy more stuffed animals than I know what to do with. Sean hates it. But this movie was very influential to me. So, like, we could have done anything for Labor Day. Dude, we could have found a Labor Day movie and done it, which I don't think there really is a Labor Day movie.
I'm sure there's at least one.
But to me, it was like, now we're doing this one. I distinctly remember the first time viewing this, because we have to get this out of the way right now. I distinctly remember viewing this going, wow, David Bowie's gorgeous. David Bowie's like this ethereal creature. And I really did think he wore the eyeliner and had that hair as a child. And then when I got into it, my dad introduced me to Ziggy Stardust. And I'm like, who's that? He's like, that's David Bowie. I'm like, that's David Bowie. He's like, no, that's David Bowie. I'm like, no, that's David Labyrinth David Bowie. And as I got older, I was like, oh, Jareth is a character. David is a man. Okay, cool. But David was really like that awakening for me. Not a sexual awakening. It was more of a, men can be pretty too. Like, wow. And then my dad was like, nah, he's been doing this since the 1670s. Here you go. Here's Ziggy Stardust. And I was like, so I really got introduced to a lot of different music through this movie too as well. I'm just going to go off on tangents. So where are we? We get to the point where Sarah has her tantrum, goes in her room and finds out that Lancelot, her bear, is missing from his cubby. And all of a sudden she goes into the, I hate you, rant, normal teenage crankiness. And she goes into her parents' room where Toby's crying. And she's acts like he's the worst thing in the world. And I thought in my head that that's how I was going to be when my new baby brother or sister was going to be born in 93. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to hate them. They're going to make my life a living hell. Spoiler alert, my brother does make my life a living hell. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. He doesn't listen to this. My mom does. So I'm going to get a call being like, don't pick on your brother. But you get to the point where she's telling the story about the goblins. And then you see the little goblins. And I love the scene where Jim Henson has all of them squished into one frame. And they're all like, oh, listen, she's going to say the words. And you can see all of like the crinkles in the mouth and like how they don't fit perfectly. But I think that's the quirkiness of this, because they're supposed to be goblins. They're supposed to be imperfect. And I love how none of the puppets in here are perfect. All of them are janky. All of them are crackly. And he even uses hands to his advantage, because a puppet master's tools are their hands. In order to bring it to life, you have to use the hands. And then you have a whole scene where it's just a fucking tunnel of hands. and they are making puppets just with their hands. I think Jim Henson really struck gold with this one, honestly. Like, there is nothing about this movie that I hate. Nothing. Not a thing. I'm just glad we don't have smell-o-vision for the Baga stench. Because I can imagine what that thing really in his mind smelled like.
Oh, no. Visually, he conveyed it as the most disgusting pit sludge.
Spoiler alert. We live in a town where our sewage treatment plant is right next to the highway. So when it's a really hot day, I can imagine what the bog of eternal stench does smell like.
Oh, God.
that fucking sewage treatment plant is also near the one mall, one of our big malls,
yeah.
World Mall. And also back in 2007, was it 2007 when the Patuxent River flooded?
I have no idea.
And because of the sewage treatment plant was right near the river and the mall, our mall was filled with sewage.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was, dude, that flood. Like, you could probably, if you're somebody that doesn't know Rhode Island, you could look up the flood in Rhode Island that ruined the Warwick Mall. It was disgusting. And when that happened as an adult, I went, oh, God, the entirety of Warwick is just the bog of eternal stench now. Oh, no, this is a tangent one. I'm sorry, guys. This one's going to be long. I'm looking at the data right now, and I'm like, oh, my God, we're in, like, the first 10 minutes of the movie. So Sarah goes on telling Toby a story and goes, Goblin King, wherever you may be. And all the puppets are like, that's not the right word. What the fuck, lady? We're going back to sleep. And as she leaves, she says, I wish the Goblin King would take you away right now. And he takes Toby. And thus ensues a 13-hour fight for her to get her little brother back.
So that scene essentially introduces us to the Goblin King,
Jared. Oh, my God. And the fact that when they open those doors and the glitter coming off the curtains and the sparkle and the lighting, you right there fall in love with David Bowie. You're like, oh, my God.
And the funny thing is that there were, like, David Bowie almost wasn't the Goblin King.
He almost was not the Goblin King. Yep.
So some of the other, it was always going to be a singer.
Yes.
Like they knew that from the beginning.
Just tell me Mick Jagger wasn't in the running.
No.
Thank God.
So some of the top contenders were Sting, who at the time was the lead singer of The Police.
Yep.
He had a bit of acting experience, so he was like a natural choice. Rod Stewart.
I can see that.
Freddie Mercury of Queen.
I don't know.
Prince.
Ooh,
was in discussion.
Oh, that's a different sexual awakening right there.
But the biggest one was the King of Pop himself, Michael Jackson.
They considered Michael Jackson for this?
Yes, because he had always dreamed of being like a movie star. They were very close to getting him, but Jim Henson went with David Bowie because he had that glam rock style, but he embodied more of what Jim Henson envisioned for the character.
Now, I could see Sting, but I also see Sting as more of a posh, and I don't mean this in an offensive way, a posh, uptight kind of British. So I think he would have been a little stiffer. Rod Stewart embodies that glam rock. I understand that one. But Rod Stewart is not what I'd envision. Fun fact, when I was a kid, I loved Rod Stewart. I had all of his tapes as a kid. When the National Guard Air Show would be here in Quonset, I hate loud noises. So every single time that show was here, I had my tape deck and my Rod Stewart tape. I had to have Rod Stewart because his voice was loud enough for me to not be able to hear the jet engines. So Rod Stewart is a great choice. His voice is amazing. I love his music. Maggie is one of my favorite songs. But I honestly could not see anybody but David. Michael Jackson would have been a great choice, but this movie would have been so much different.
There's a lot of little things about Jareth that I kind of want to cover.
Okay.
Because he's a very prominent character in this movie. Apparently, his overall vibe was inspired by a cross between Jane Erie and Marlon Brando, which I think I can see a little bit. least on the Brando side.
Jane Eyre, yeah, I guess because it's that very, like, okay, it's hard to describe because I don't know Jane Eyre that well, but it's that, like, Pride and Prejudice kind of sense and sensibility, that very kind of, like, regal early 1900s, like, British. I can kind of see that, but Marlon Brando? Like, I'm gonna make him an offer. Get that guy? Is that Marlon Brando?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. I don't get either one of those in the performance.
I get the Brando stuff. Like, he carries himself in a similar way to a lot of Brando's performances. Apparently, David Bowie, despite what you may think while watching the movie, could not juggle.
No. They did a very good job with hiding the fact that there was somebody else behind him doing the crystals the entire time. That is not David Bowie, and I was disappointed as a teenager finding out that David Bowie had no crystal twirling skills.
It's honestly unbelievable how well it's hidden.
It is.
Because it looks very natural. Like, it's actually him.
Yeah, they did a lot of good camera work where he's doing this one in the front of him with when he's introducing Sarah.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay, so David learned how to do... Anybody can do it. You can't. I broke two crystals trying to learn how to do this shit, guys.
But even the shots where it's like front and center, David Bowie, and his hand is twirling those crystals.
Those crystals in the windowsill, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm really convinced. You've got to pay attention to see his shoulder back too far and the arm too far forward to, like, even know, but it's because they used the dark fabric. They hit it very well. They did camera tricks. It's like, damn.
It's crazy accurate.
It is very good.
And young Toby didn't like David very much.
No.
At least not in costume.
No, he cried every... the kid that played Toby, his real name is Toby. I thought it was really cute. He cried every time he saw David Bowie. And in the special features, there's like a behind the scenes thing where Sarah is, or Jennifer is holding Toby and he's calm. And David turns the corner and goes, oh shit. And he just starts crying. He goes, well, I gotta go. Like, and I don't even know if it's on this special features because I saw it years and years and years ago. But it's so funny how this David in costume just terrified this 2-3-year-old little boy.
Well, that's the cool thing, because there's a lot of scenes where David has to hold Toby and he has to interact with him in sequences. And, like, there's one notable one where, like, I guess he's holding Toby. I tried to look for it in the movie, but he's holding him and he's, like, kind of whispering into his ear. And the only way that they could pull that off, like, you can notice that Toby's kind of just staring off into, like, the distance.
I think his mom's off camera.
No.
No?
They achieved that by having David was holding him, but his arm is out of frame. So he's holding him and playing with a little sock puppet that the crew just happened to have.
Aww.
So he's distracting him so he's not paying attention.
Aww, it's so really cute. Cool. I love it. Oh my god. Yeah, there's notable times where the magic is broken a couple of times in this. Not a lot, but the magic is broken when he's like, oh, I have a gift for you. It's a crystal. And the scene that they have in the crystal doesn't match the scene that you're actually watching. Like, David's mouth is moving in the crystal differently than the other one. So you can tell that, like, maybe they just didn't fix the take in there, or...
See, but things like that are forgivable.
Oh, yeah.
There's all this magic and mysticism.
It's a fantasy movie, so you're not supposed to be 100% believing that this shit's actually happening.
Yeah. Something that we skipped over that I'd like to draw attention to was that this movie opens with a shot of an owl. It's like our opening credit sequence.
Yeah.
That owl was the first computer-generated animal ever.
Ever, yes.
That's incredible.
And looking at it now, you're like, this is a piece of trash.
Oh, it looks like shit.
It looks like horrible. But back then, people were like, oh my god, because you can't really train an owl to do a lot of that stuff. I mean, the owl that they had on scene to fly and do little things, kind of could, but, you know,
Excuse me.
You can't really get an owl to like, all right, hit your mark. You can kind of get a cat or dog to do that, but an owl, yeah, no, they're gonna go be themselves. So we get to, Sarah is introduced to the labyrinth, and the game is you have 13 hours to find your baby brother before he turns into a goblin and becomes Jareth's subject forever. So ensues her going to the front of the labyrinth and meeting Hoggle, or Hogwart. I really would love to know if that is where J.K. Rowling got Hogwart from.
Honestly, probably.
Because that's the first time you hear the word Hogwart. Maybe she got it from something else, but I've always thought in my head, like, oh man, is that how she named Hogwarts? I'm probably going to get schooled by all the Potterheads, but you know, whatever. You meet Hoggle, who I think is one hell of a puppet. It's a full body puppet.
Yeah, it's like an actual actor, but then there's
It's a
mechanical face. Yep. And
it's not an actual like puppeteering head. It's a mechanical head, which is really, really cool.
I think I read somewhere that it took 6 different people to puppet him.
Jesus.
Which is crazy.
Now, here's the question I have for you. Who is the actor in that? Is it Warwick?
I don't know.
Because I think Warwick would be doing Willow at this point.
So, no. So the physical actor is someone named Shari Weiser.
Okay.
And the voice of Hoggle is actually Brian Henson.
Yeah, I always knew Brian Henson was the voice of Hoggle. Because I like Brian Henson. I think he's cool. What is our next? So we open... Hoggle opens the labyrinth. And we're introduced to the labyrinth. It's not an ordinary maze. A labyrinth is a maze that can change at any time depending on how you move a labyrinth. They're very interesting puzzles. Very old, ancient kind of puzzle. The labyrinth is built on a tilting kind of access. So if you tilt it one way, the doors from one way can close and new ones can open. So a labyrinth is ever-changing, ever expanding. So there isn't just one linear path to take. There are many. The problem is the path you just took could change in an instant. So you can never really backtrack in a labyrinth. There's also supposed to be a giant minotaur in a labyrinth, but really glad that there wasn't one in this movie.
Well, I mean, you kind of have the
Ludo
character who's similar.
He is based off of, and I think I read this somewhere, he is based off of Where the Wild Things Are.
That makes sense.
And that's one of the books that is in Sarah's room. Everything in here is based off of a book or a fantasy. Like Sir Didymus and Ambrosius, Ludo, Hoggle. They're all based on different stories.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the movie, you meet Sarah's dog, mm-hmm. who's named Merlin.
Merlin.
It's also used as
Ambrosius
later in the movie. And I didn't know, but in Joffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, Merlin is called Merlin Ambrosius. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a double name. So calling him Merlin in the beginning is, you know, you'd think somebody who's into fantasy, that makes sense. But only really real like historian fantasy nerds will know that it is supposed to be a nod to it's the same dog.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. It's really cool. I love it. There's all sorts of little things like that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
God, I'm losing. This is the first film that I know everything about, but my brain just goes scatterbrained all over this film that I can't stay on a linear track. So I apologize if I jump, if I go off tangents. So she's in the labyrinth, and we come up to my favorite character in the entire fucking movie. The worm. Hello.
Hello.
No, I said hello, but that's close enough. He is this tiny little worm, but in real life, he was as big as an arm. Like, can you imagine that life-size puppet? He was an arm-sized puppet. All the detail on that, I thought he was probably one of my favorites. And he's a simple character. Because he's just, no, I'm just a worm. Come inside and have a cup of tea with the missus. How the hell was she going to get inside there when you are this big and she is human size? Like, I've always wanted their own adventure. What if Sarah just went in and had a cup of tea and lived there?
Well, that's something you could ask a lot about this movie. What if she had done it? What if she had turned left instead of right?
Yep.
What if she
would have listened to the worm and went down the other way and gotten to the castle right away? We wouldn't have the story that we do.
Exactly.
But I also think that the curse of the labyrinth is the residents cannot tell you exactly how to solve it.
Correct.
Like, they are not the curse of the labyrinth. You cannot strictly say, oh, you go that way, you'll get there. Because he says, no, don't go that way. He says it in an emphasis like, no, you should go that way. But Sarah is still very naive, very childlike, to where she's going to literally listen to them. By the end, she gets it, that not everything is what it seems.
That's a cool bit of information.
Mm-hmm.
Producer George Lucas chose not to do any interviews during the release of this movie as to not steal Jim Henson's thunder, who was at the time one of his best friends until he passed away.
Oh.
That's really cool.
Because you see George Lucas's name on this film. You don't, like, he's not in the opening where you put producer and stuff. He is in the scrolling credits at the end. I have to say, I've never been a fan of George the person, but after watching Light and Magic, and after, like, learning things as an adult, George Lucas is a very misunderstood human being.
People
hate on him for the prequels, and I will agree. I hated on him because of the prequels. Because I don't think he did the story justice. But I also think he was hindered by storytelling, by financials, and by the technology that he needed to convey his story.
Well, imagine this. Like, imagine if the marketing for this movie had said stuff like,
produced by George
directed
Lucas.
By Jim Henson, produced by George Lucas. You would have had the same thing that happened with Gremlins.
Yeah.
So Gremlins was directed by Joe Dante, produced by Steven Spielberg.
Mm.
But because at the beginning of that movie, it says Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins.
Yeah.
Everybody just assumed that he directed it.
Yeah.
And Joe Dante got no fucking credit for it. Which, I mean, he got credit for it, but most people just didn't know that it was his. And in doing that, in allowing his name to be kind of left off of it, in the public eye at least, he gave Jim Henson the opportunity to, like, stake his claim.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that a lot of people wouldn't do. Fucking Spielberg didn't do it.
But I also don't think Spielberg had bad intentions. I think Spielberg was like, let's get this movie out there. Let's get people talking about it.
But shit happens.
Yeah.
Like, and I think George Lucas knew that. Like,
Was Gremlins before or after this?
Oh, God. I think it was before.
So maybe George and Steven, because you know that Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were really good friends. Maybe he's like, don't learn from my mistakes. Don't put your name on the movie. Maybe they actually had a talk about that.
Gremlins was 84.
Honestly, the way George Lucas talks about his friends in this, like, he let his friends use Industrial Light and Magic. I mean, in this moment in time, I have to tell you, the most remarkable thing about that, this whole thing is becoming like about this documentary. I'm so pissed. But guys, the fourth episode is about Jurassic Park. That episode blew my mind. And it blew my mind how caring Steven Spielberg really was, because
finding out, we'll go into more detail because we are going to do Jurassic Park in this podcast, finding out that someone was going to lose their job because of a decision that Spielberg made about technology. Finding that information out, Steven Spielberg went, no, you're not gone. You're still going to be part of this project, and here's why. I realized that Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, all of those directors really did care about their teams, really cared about the people that were around them, really cared about their friends. So knowing that Lucas left his name off of this project to make sure that Henson and the Jim Henson Company had their day in the sun, I commend them. I honestly do. But I don't want to give a lot away about Jurassic Park, because you and I can go into fucking... Jurassic Park is going to be close to a 3-hour episode. I'm not even kidding. Hold on to your butts, kids. Oh my God, I didn't even realize that's one of his lines. I got it. All right, backtrack. Going back to the labyrinth. We're getting out of dinosaurs. We're going into fantasy.
Where were we?
So everybody knows the story of the labyrinth. Everybody knows the journey that Sarah makes. In the beginning, she meets the shield dudes that you have to figure out which door will take you to the castle and which one will go boom, 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 certain death. And I've always liked those. And that actually, Sean, if you Google the shield puzzle door question, people are still trying to figure out which door would lead to the castle and which wouldn't. To this day, no one can solve that mystery.
Oh my God.
She thinks she figured it out, but she ended up in the oubliette. Was that right or was that wrong? No one has said yes or no.
Well, that's the problem. You're never going to entirely know what... She probably still would have had to go through some turmoil, even if she got the answer right.
Yep.
So...
if she went up instead of going down, would they lead her back up and would she have gone right to that castle? Every time that scene plays and she falls, I pause and I look to see if I could see anything, because there is a glimmer of like white and blue in the back, and I'm like, is that the castle? Does that lead directly to the castle, or was it just, you know, a red herring? Like, this movie for years has baffled me. I went on a deep dive when the internet was still young, back in 2002 2001. Back when, are you ready? I had to log into AOL.com under my screen name. Do you want to know what my screen name was? LIP1132.
LIP1132?
Yep, can you figure that one out?
No.
Leah Ian Page 11 3 and 2.
Jesus Christ.
Yep. That was my AOL screen name for years. I never changed it. And it was funny when I would log on. But back then, if y'all remember the AOL noise, I'm going to see if I can have Sean find the AOL noise and put it into this.
Yeah.
You hear that and you just go, ugh, mom, get off the phone. But I did a deep dive years and years ago of this movie because I was just really curious. That was over 20 years ago. Holy shit.
You were right.
What?
Mick Jagger was considered.
Oh, God. Can you imagine Mick Jagger in that part?
Oh, no. Absolutely not.
Not at all. I'm not a Rolling Stones fan. I'm not a Mick Jagger fan. But when Keith Richards showed up in Pirates of the Caribbean, I did cheer.
Yeah, that's true. That was a good part for him.
Because, you know, Depp based it off of fucking Keith Richards. Right. So that made so much sense. The next set of characters that were introduced her to is the dude with the talking thing. Oh no, there's the cleaner. So I thought that scene was a little violent for kids. The cleaners.
It was very Indiana Jones.
It really was. Like, okay, you have this obstacle that you have to get through and da da da. But I was like, this thing is literally a cone with like shredder and metal and knives and stuff, and it's coming at this girl and it's going to absolutely kill her. Was that Jareth's intention all along, or did he know she was gonna escape? Like, was he just toying with her this entire time? Jim Henson, I need you to undie and tell me all of this shit. How about Terry Jones? Can you explain to me what you meant by half of this shit, please?
Well, as much as you hate it, the point is for you to fill in the gaps.
Yep. I hate when movies don't answer questions. This is a movie that I saw 30 years ago, and I'm still like, why aren't my questions answered? I first saw this movie almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. Welcome to adulthood, Shippy.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I feel like that right now. One of our cats is sleeping. She's on her side. But her head is completely upside down. And she looks like she's dead. That's how I feel. And then we meet Ludo. Oh, Ludo. I love Ludo. Rock's friends. And I feel like Ludo is another representation of childhood innocence. Like, that carefree, like, you just want to make friends, you just want to be loved kind of thing. I've always thought of Ludo as, like, this sweet, lovely creature that, you know, you're always going to have those people by your side no matter what. That's what I thought Ludo would be. Yeah. Or was.
You know, the original costume rig for him weighed over 100 pounds.
I could imagine.
I guess Jim Henson told the Creature Shop guys to start all over, make it lighter, and they were only able to bring it down to 75 pounds. So,
damn.
It's still too heavy to be operated by one person. So, Rob Mills and Ron, I can't say your last name, man. they split the performance.
Mm. Damn. Yeah, because you do notice that he kind of leans a little and his arms don't move. And it's supposed to be a fantastical character. Yeah. So I never had a problem with it. But as I've gotten older, I'm like, that thing looks like it's fucking, like, heavy.
I think it looks pretty good, though.
It does.
Sells the effect.
It looks very good for the mid-80s. What's the next big scene? She rescues Ludo. She meets the fire gang. Chili gang. I don't remember what these dudes are called, but they're the little red and orange kind of things that this is the real part of the movie where you're like, I can see through the cracks because it's all green screened. We know for a fact it's all green screened. And each one of those puppets, I believe, is two or three, almost four separate people, because it's someone puppeting the head. And it's someone doing the torso and someone doing the legs and the arms. And it's supposed to be able to separate, be able to kind of come apart in parts and then put itself back together and dance. But with green screen and fuzz and fur and hair, you can see the illusion through the hair, through the fuzz. And that's the only thing that, like, now as it ages, it's completely broke down. Because you have movies like, you know, Marvel movies, you have all of these like amazing graphical movies where you do not see edges, you don't see problems, you don't see issues. This is the only one where you're like, I can see the green screen through Jennifer's hair. I can see the green screen, or I can see the outline of somebody in their green outfit if they move too fast. And it doesn't take me out of it now, because I think it's very like, aw, like that kind of thing. But it is the only part of this movie where you're like, oh, well, the illusion is cracked just a bit. And even as a kid, I could see it. I was like, why does this look so, like, weird?
So, to interject, I have a couple of little things here.
Mm.
I wish I had known this one earlier. The movie is loosely based on a children's picture book called Outside Over There.
Outside Over There.
It's written and illustrated by Maurice Sendak in 1981. And the story of that book follows young Ida, who must enter a fantastical world described as outside over there to find her baby sister, who's been spirited away by some goblins.
I never knew that.
The same person wrote the book Where the Wild Things Are, which is seen in the bedroom at the beginning of the film.
Yes.
So that's a really cool little nod. And to slightly answer one of your questions, an ongoing joke in the movie, as we know, is Hoggle's name being mispronounced as Hogwart. Hogwart originally comes from the famous British humor book, The Complete Molesworth, by Geoffrey Willens and Ronald Searle? Searle? So it's much more likely that Rowling took the Hogwart's name from that.
Oh. Well, that stinks. I wanted to come from the labyrinth.
It very well still might, but since that's apparently a famous book in British culture.
Yeah, in British culture, that maybe make more sense.
Yeah.
Fire gang. Okay, so Hoggle rescues her from the Chili gang, the fire gang, who she, to get away from them, she throws their heads. And they're like, oh, okay, now we have to take your head off. And they realize their head doesn't come off. There is a stuffed animal of one of the Chili gang or the fire gang in her bedroom. I have been looking for information on this my entire life because I've wanted to know what the exact words for the song are and I never found them. And I've always wanted to know what book or what movie or what that came from, and I've never been able to find it. But the fire gang dude is in her bedroom. You see it in the opening sequence. He's a stuffed animal. I'm like, where did this come from? And I don't know a lot of children literature, because when I was younger I didn't read a lot of kids books. I read a lot of Babysitter's Club, Goosebumps, even when I was like 7, 8, 9 years old. Like R.L. Stine and the Babysitter's Club were like at their height when I was a kid. So I never really read a lot of like Where the Wild Things Are. I didn't know till I was older, a lot of those other books. And that's one of those things that have plagued me all my life. So she escapes them because Hoggle saves her. She kisses Hoggle, thanking him, and then they fall to the bog of Eternal Stench, where they escape and meet Sir Didymus. He is a fox, I think he's supposed to be. And I've always wondered if he came from a book too. Like all of these characters that she makes up in this story, like they're supposed to be in a world where it's just goblins, but there's all these mystical fantasy characters that just came from her head, and it's adorable. So Ludo and him have a fight, they become friends, they go to escape, the bridge collapses, and Ludo calls the rocks. Now, you pointed this out when we were watching, and he's like, you totally can still step in it. You'll totally still smell.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's not so much... They establish through Hoggle that if you were to fall in or anything like that, you would smell forever.
Yeah.
He even says if you step in that stuff, you'll smell forever. However, like, so wouldn't it count that those rocks are covered in the stuff?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you still smell forever?
Yeah, I know Sarah and Hoggle have shoes on, so they're not going to smell forever.
The shoes might smell forever.
Yeah, but then Ludo is barefoot and so is Ambrosius.
Yeah.
Aren't they going to smell forever?
You would think.
What if they were to say if you get it on your skin? Like, oh, if you get it on your actual skin or if you put your hand in there. Like, I would have liked that more than, oh, if it gets on you, you're going to smell forever.
Yeah.
Because then at that point, you're sitting there as a kid going, he just totally put his whole fucking foot in that. Like, ew.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was a slightly overlooked thing.
I also love how the Bog of Eternal Stench is burping and farting noises the entire time.
Well, to be fair, it's got little, like, puckering assholes
it
all
does,
over the
place. It really does. It's just like... the entire time. And it's so funny because I'm like, this movie uses potty humor and I love it. And that's where now it makes sense that it's somebody from Monty Python that wrote it.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh yeah, that's British potty humor. That makes total sense now.
Did you know that there are hidden faces throughout this movie?
Yes. So when he's giving Hoggle the peach,
I know that
David
one.
Bowie's face is right there. But there are hidden faces all over this movie. Yes.
I didn't notice any of the other ones. That one was very apparent.
They're in the branches in the labyrinth. A lot of them are there in the rocks, in the textures.
Mm.
It's supposed to be because Jareth is always watching.
That's cool. Because, like, I assumed that the one that's made up of the rocks, like the force perspective one, I assumed that that was supposed to be Jareth's face.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's really cool. Like, they should have done more of that. And apparently they did, and I just didn't notice them.
They're very faint. It's a fact that I learned years ago, and then I try to watch for them. They're extremely faint.
Well, I don't think they were in every version of the movie either. They, according to this at least, started with the DVD version. They, like, worked them in.
They're my original. I have the special edition DVD version that first came out in the early 2000s. I bought that one. That one, you can see them a little more. The Blu-ray, I will say this movie transferred beautifully onto Blu-ray. I didn't see a lot of issues, but the only thing I love about the VHS is what you love, is the aging. The fact that this movie has little bits of skips, little bits of, like, the flare, the tape flare, I like that more than the crispness of seeing the movie, because at points it was too clear.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I can see little things that you're not supposed to. Like when the little things are biting Ludo, I can see the little strings in their mouth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this wasn't meant for Blu-ray.
Right.
This wasn't meant for high quality. The fact that it was such poor quality on film was supposed to be able to help Jim Henson. And you can see lines. You can see wires. It's like, no! But that's what makes this movie that more precious in my mind to fans. Because they made it knowing that the quality would help them. But like George Lucas said, like Star Wars at one point, he said this in the documentary, Star Wars and stuff like this, where you use that to your advantage. Eventually, technology will get better. He even said it. He even got reprimanded for putting the prequels onto digital rather than film. And he got chastised for it because you can see the errors in the original movies.
We gotta stop talking about.
I'm really sorry.
Magic.
But it really it's very now.
Yes.
This movie is. I'm sorry.
Where were we?
All right. So they get out of the Bog of Eternal Stench and they make it to the forest where everybody's like, oh, we're really hungry. And Hoggle hands her a peach that Jarrah said, you'll make her eat this. And it's like, oh, you're hungry. I have a peach. She bites it and immediately she's like, this tastes funny. What's wrong? And he's like, oh, damn you, Jarrah. And then it goes to one of the most beautiful sequences of the movie. It's the bubble where she's this beautiful, mystic, gorgeous princess in this shimmering white gown that I wanted for my prom, but didn't realize that in 2003, you don't want to wear that.
No.
No. I was like, I wanted this as a wedding dress. As a child, that's what I wanted as a wedding dress. The big old 80s poof sleeve with the poof dress. Can you imagine me wearing something like that now?
That'd be ridiculous.
Oh my God, I'd kill myself. But it is one of the most beautiful scenes, and it's the scene where everybody's like, oh my God, Jarrah is in love with Sarah. I was like, no, he's distracting her. He's literally distracting her from what she's supposed to be doing. Because while they're dancing and he's singing that beautiful As the World Falls Down song. This soundtrack, by the way, is gorgeous. I have it on vinyl. I love playing it on vinyl. It's probably one of my favorite soundtracks for movies because it's got the 80s synth and it's got the drums and it's an interesting soundtrack. But David's adding the music to it is really great. So she breaks free of the bubble once she realizes that, oh, I have to do something. I have to escape. And then the next scene is her going to the junkyard and ending up in her bedroom and realizing, oh, it was all a dream. Then the garbage girl, I don't know what her name is. I used to know. She breaks in and she's like, oh, you love this toy. Don't you love this toy? Don't you want this toy? And starts kind of piling on her things that she loves to make her like this little hoarder turtle.
Well, that was something I thought was kind of cool, was like, she starts like shoving all that, like that stuff in her face. And I guess originally that character was supposed to be like another puppet of Jarrah's.
Yeah.
Jarrah's. And I just thought that was a cool way to do it, because she was essentially trying to make her like her.
Yeah.
So she was like putting all this stuff on her back, the way she has stuff piled on her back.
Yeah, you can't let go. You don't let go. You have to keep everything. And it's when Sarah realizes, this is all junk. This is not important to me. Like, that's when you really see the transition of this little girl growing up into something different, where she's like, I can appreciate the things I own, but I need to grow up and keep track of what is important to me. So she escapes, and her, Hoggle, Ludo, and Sir Didymus and Ambrosius go to the Goblin City. They go in, they get intercepted by like almost what is like this metal Goliath goblin thing that starts attacking them. And I love how the jankiness of this puppet is used to Henson's advantage, because it's huge. It's janky. It's not going to work correctly. And it's a goblin puppeting it, so you know it's definitely not going to work correctly. And it's swinging its thing and getting stuck. And oh my God, that is one of the cooler puppets. And the Force perspective, because that puppet's really not that big.
Yeah.
It's not fucking 20 feet tall.
No, they make it look like it's humongous.
They do, because they actually force perspective so well that none of this is green screened. It's all like the puppet is on something higher and way behind, and they're filming from behind it down to where they look like, oh my God, this thing's giant. It's really not. I love force perspective. I really wasn't 100% aware of force perspective till Lord of the Rings, till I was taught how they did Gandalf versus Frodo in the carriage or in some of those scenes. And then I was like, oh, I wonder if that's what they used for this movie or that movie. Turns out I was right. That's what they used for all these other movies too. That sequence is pretty cool. They defeat that. They get into the Goblin City. Chaos ensues. Jareth is alerted that she's there. It's like 15 minutes till the time's over. He sends all the goblins out. Ludo calls all the rocks. Chaos absolutely ensues. You have rocks and goblins and blowing up poor little goblin things into rocks.
That
was funny.
That is the most hectic scene of the movie.
That must have been the most fun to film, too. Because my favorite is the dudes on the little ostrich things where they're puppeting it by having their hand here in the little dude's mouth. There's a hand here, their other hand's here, and then their feet are the little dude. And it's like, this, they're just one whole full person. The puppet is this, and then their other hand. Those puppets are the coolest ones.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, how are they going to do that? And then you learn later through, like, Jim Henson's had many documentaries teaching you stuff. You learn stuff about the Dark Crystal in this. I would like to watch the specials on this because I think there are new specials on this Blu-ray for behind the scenes stuff. We should have watched some of that too to have some fun facts, but this episode's already pretty long. So we get to, they get through everybody, they get into the Goblin Castle, and Sarah says, I've got to do this by myself. And they're like, oh, should you need us, we'll be here for you. And then she goes into what is one of my favorite paintings of all time. It's the upside down, the stairs. It is essentially an old god.
It's the
painting.
The famous M.C. Escher painting. I forget what it's actually called.
I don't remember what it's called, but it's arches and stairways going up and down, doors to nowhere, you know, stairs that lead to a sheer drop. It's supposed to be very, like, mind-blowing, something that the human mind can't understand. I've always thought of it as kind of like an old god thing, where this is what the mind of an old god is. You'll never fully understand. Even when I was like teenagers, when I first started getting into Cthulhu, because if you live in Rhode Island and you don't get into Lovecraft, I mean, who are you? You know? But Sarah's trying to get to Toby, and Toby is crawling around this thing. And let me tell you, I hope to God that they just let that 3-year-old or 2-year-old just wander around that set like that. Okay, you wander. We're just going to record you and just let him have fun.
The name of the Escher painting or stairs is Relativity.
Relativity, yep. And then ensues Jareth kind of walking around, going after Sarah. Sarah's trying to get Toby, and Toby's just, you know, fucking around on the stairs and in the arches and shit, and it's funny. He ends up upside down. And you see at one point, Jareth throws a crystal and Toby catches it. That whole scene right there is, I think, what may have spawned the comic. Because at that point, if Toby can catch that, Toby's been in there long enough to where maybe Jared saw him as, you're not going to be a goblin. You will be the next, you know, successor at that point, which I thought was really, really cool. So then Sarah realizes she has to jump through the center of this in order to defeat him. They get to the bottom, and he literally just grovels at her feet, says, I'll give you everything in the world if you don't do this, basically. And she quotes the book again, through dangers untold and hardships unnumbered, I have traveled beyond the beyond the Goblin City to the castle to take back the child you have stolen through me. My will is as strong as yours, and my kingdom is great. You have no power over me. Yes, I memorized that.
Yeah, that ending was different in the original script.
Yes, I knew that.
Yeah, I guess it originally was written that she was going to punch and kick him and then watch him shrink down until he becomes a small and sniveling goblin. Which kind of would have been cool.
It would have been cool, But at the same time,
I think they should have crossed those two ideas. Like, I think they should have had her words cause him to shrink down into a goblin.
Into a goblin. But then there wouldn't have been the possibility of... There was talks for a second Labyrinth movie for a very long... There is still talks for a second Labyrinth movie.
Listen, Bowie's gone. You can't do it.
No. I mean, and let me tell you, David Bowie left this world. Everybody was heartbroken. He told no one. The only one that knew he was sick was his wife and his family.
Yeah.
And he put out Black Star. Have you ever listened to Black Star?
It doesn't come to mind.
No. Black Star was the last album he put out before he died, and it was the album he did while he was sick.
Oh.
It is... It's almost gives me the same feeling as Chadwick Boseman does, to where I'm going to continue to work, I will not let this defeat me, and I will continue to go on until it is my time to go. Black Star is an incredible album that takes you on a weird sound journey. The song Black Star, I listened to it, and it's very Ziggy Stardust. It's very David Bowie. It's very experimental, and it is very cool. You should probably... I would recommend you listen to it just to listen to it once.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll like it at all.
We'll
see. It's not the type of music that a lot of people would listen to, but you can feel the pain, and you can feel how devastated this man was, that he's like, I don't have any more time left, so I'm just going to do what I need to. But yeah, there was talks about a Labyrinth 2, just like there was talks about a second Dark Crystal. But now Dark Crystal, the second one, still haven't watched it, is a limited series.
Yeah. And I think that's the way they should have done it.
Yeah.
Like, if you were gonna continue this, do it in a longer form.
The only way you can get away with Dark Crystal being a second one, a limited series, is because there were no people. It was all puppetry.
Right.
This one, you have two distinct people that... Yeah, Jennifer Connelly's still around. She's in her 50s. Toby's still around. He's in his 40s. You could still do a story. There is no David Bowie. And, I mean, there are plenty of younger actors now that could encapsulate the magic that is David Bowie. Look at Rami Malek. Look at, you know, all of these people that you could give these possible whimsical characters to. But at the same time, who's going to fill that Bowie bulge?
Nobody can fill the Bowie bulge.
Honestly, rewatching this with you, I realized the scene where David gives Hoggle... Or, I'm sorry, Jareth gives Hoggle the peach. Hoggle is eye level with David Bowie's crotch. And I've always wanted to ask Jim Henson, did you mean for everybody to be able to look at his fucking junk right there? In tight snake leather pants. Just being able to be like, here is my dick. This is a children's movie. This was marketed as a PG kids movie. Why does everybody only talk about the Bowie bulge?
Because it's very prominent.
Oh, David. You had a nice boulder in there.
Oh, God.
Did Ludo call that one out? Oh.
So after Sarah basically...
She defeats
takes
him.
Away Jareth's power.
Yep.
They are sent home.
Yep. She ends up being in the foyer of her house with the clock going off. And it's then and there that you realize how much of the things in the labyrinth look like her home. And you sit there in your mind thinking, was this an actual journey? Or did this poor little girl just have a psychotic break?
I think if anything, it was her imagination running wild.
Which I've always admired, that imagination. I had an imagination growing up. But once I hit, like, teenage years, my imagination is shit. I don't really have a great imagination anymore. Like, I can't... If I try to remember things in my brain, it's very cloudy. I don't have crystal clear vision. Like, I can't go on a fantastical journey like that unless I watch a movie or read a book. But just knowing that that girl's imagination was that vivid and that wild, it's like, oof, I wish... And I hope that people who have that kind of vivid imagination and creativity don't ever let it go. Because that is just wild. So she ends up going back to her room. Her parents come home. And when her parents come home, you see her putting things away. She's putting away all of the things that she just went through. you can see that she's growing up, that she realizes that, you know, maybe it's time. Maybe I don't have to forget who I was, but maybe I have to kind of move forward at this point. And it's kind of sad. And then all the characters come back, you know, oh, do you need us? Should you need us? And all of that sweet and lovable stuff is broken because now there's a goblin party in her room. With Jared watching from outside as the owl. So it left it open for a possible sequel at that point in my mind, but nothing was ever done.
Unfortunately.
Honestly, I don't want a sequel to this.
I think it would have been cool if it had been done back then.
Hmm.
But unfortunately.
Now I think it would be too technical, too advanced. This needed Jim Henson's puppetry. This needed the whimsy. I think technology is so far now that I think it would just be ruined, in my opinion.
I agree. That covers the Labyrinth.
Movie, yeah.
Are we moving on to closing questions?
Yeah, because if you keep letting me talk, I'm just going to talk for hours.
Okay. Overall thoughts on the film?
Do I have to say it? I've talked about this movie for, what, 2 hours? I love this film. I love it. I love it for its meaning. I love it for what it gave me growing up. I love it for what it still gives me. It gives me hope. It gives me imagination. It gives me this, the world isn't so bad if there's Jim Henson and puppets and David Bowie.
Yeah, I think that this is a crowning achievement. Like, I think that this is a very strong movie with a very strong message.
Mm.
I think that it's very apparent that this was a passion project and that this is somebody doing something that was unprecedented at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a love letter to an art form that is dying.
It's not dead yet.
It's not dead yet, but it is. It's dying in a sense. I don't think it'll ever go away completely, but it's something that a lot of people just don't utilize anymore, and it hurts me personally. I think this is it's a phenomenal film.
Yeah.
Like, if you've never seen it, I think you should.
Yes.
Like, I think it's a really, it kills me that kids growing up now
don't know what this is
and will never be shown this when they're children.
Yeah.
Any favorites?
The whole fucking thing. So my favorite scene, and has always been my favorite scene, is the opening, where she comes out in that beautiful Renaissance kind of gown and starts spouting the lines like it's a play, and you realize she's alone in the park talking to a dog. The opening is still my favorite. My favorite song is the song that she's running home to. It's called Underground. That's my favorite. That whole beginning sequence is my favorite, because you're being introduced to this character who just doesn't want to grow up. Clear that she's 15, 16, 17 years old and just doesn't want to, you know?
I don't specifically have any favorite scenes or characters or anything like that. My favorite thing about this movie is the practical nature of it all. Like, even the stuff done digitally, barring the owl in the opening credits, are really cool digital effects that, like, had physical elements to them.
Mm.
But the puppetry is the star of this one. It's gorgeous. And the puppets in this stand apart from anything else Jim Henson did. Like, the closest thing you can relate it to is Dark Crystal, because it's a similar vibe.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact that he made it up clear when they started this movie that he didn't want the puppetry in this to be anything to be connected to, like, the Muppets in any way.
Yeah.
Even, like, his core team that he had worked with forever, he made it clear that they weren't allowed to do the voices for any of these characters because he didn't want that connection.
Yeah, because it was only him and Brian that were on this. Everybody else was different.
I think his puppeteers probably worked on this movie, but they weren't allowed to have spoken dialogue.
Yeah.
Which is really, really interesting. It shows that he was trying to do something different with this movie, and he was doing everything he possibly could to keep that idea of childish cartoons,
that whimsy, out of it,
out of it, and give you a more a darker and still fun.
Yeah. If the story. Muppets were a kid's thing, Labyrinth was the young adult. Dark Crystal's the adult.
Yes.
That's how I've always felt.
Does it work?
Yes. End of story, point blank. Yes. I have no reasoning. I have no backups to it. It just works because in my mind, I'm biased, but it's perfect, even with its flaws.
I don't think you're wrong. Like I think it works despite the fact that you can see through the cracks, that you can figure out how the effects are done. I think that it works because it's visually strong enough to envelop you into the story.
Mm.
It just captivates you, and you kind of let all the other details fall away.
Yeah.
Would you recommend it?
More than any other movie I have ever recommended. I recommend this one because if you've never seen it, you should. If you hate puppets, if you don't like music, if you hate fun, still watch this. This movie is not just a simple kids movie. It's more of teaching you to be able to, sometimes you've got to let go, but you don't forget. We all have had things in the past few years. The last 2 to 3 years have been fucking rough for every single person. This movie teaches you, you gotta move on, but do not forget. Even if it's a simple little thing, you just gotta keep going. That's it. I will recommend this every day for the rest of my life.
I agree. I also recommend this movie. I recommend this to anyone who enjoys practical effects. I recommend this to anyone who hasn't seen it.
Mm.
I recommend this to kids. I recommend this to parents. I recommend that you show this to your kids while they're still kids, while they can still just fall in love with it for what it is.
Yes.
And let the story influence them in a way.
Don't explain what this is to your kids. Put it in, let them watch it, and let them piece together what it is now. I'm 36 years old. I watched this movie almost 30 years ago. I still am trying to understand why, and I'm to this day still going, this is why I love this movie. I'm still piecing it to things in my childhood. You know, there are a lot of things about this movie that I've pieced together that I won't tell people because that's very like personal to me, but every single person can connect to this film.
How would you make this today?
I wouldn't. And here's why I wouldn't. With the cracks, with the personal, with the not personal effects, fuck, with the practical effects, Jim Henson did this movie right. He did it well. I believe if you do it now, Jim Henson's not here to put his signature mark. His brother still is. His team still is. There are people that are still here that could do almost as good, but it will never be this movie.
No, I agree. I don't think this should ever be done again. I think it's had its successor with the comic series.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you tried to do this today, you would do it too big. I think you would make it way too much, way more than it has to be.
This doesn't need the Marvel treatment.
No. And this should be something like Star Wars. The original Star Wars. If somebody tried to remake Star Wars,
they would kill them.
Fucking, yeah. This, it's a benchmark. And it should remain that.
Yep.
It should remain something that you can look back on and feel nostalgic, but also realize that we wouldn't be where we are today without some things like this.
There are tons of movies that are like that.
I would say there's about 50 movies that are this is where things got better.
Yeah.
This is where technology, this is where filmmaking, this is where acting, this is where, you know, small things change for the better. I believe this movie is one of those where the way a story was interpreted, the way it was told, the reason why this is a cult following for so many children of the 80s and 90s is because of how they did this. It cannot be duplicated.
Well, that brings us to our big question. Is this mainstream exploitation or other?
This is mainstream. This was needed in the 80s. And yeah. Point blank, this is mainstream.
Yeah, I agree. This is definitely a mainstream movie. There's nothing you can really... You could maybe argue that it's other.
For fantasy, yeah.
That would be as far as I would go. It's definitely not exploitation.
But it's not high fantasy. That's the thing. Like, this is
pretty close.
It's pretty high, but it's not like Lady Hawk. Lady Hawk was high fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, this is spectacular.
It's visionary.
It's beautiful.
But that brings our discussion on The Labyrinth to an end. But don't go anywhere just yet. Stay tuned for the coming attractions.
House.
Sito. Watashi anata wo tsukurenakatta.
I see in your eyes where tomorrow is hiding in my heart. There's a bell ringing loud at the touch of your lips. Down the rainbow I'm sliding, little arrows keep falling as thick as a cloud.
Mabushikute kowai no yo.
Nothing about what you just watched.
I know a very little.
So this movie was not a recommendation, but this movie was one that we have seen the poster for many times. It's a very famous poster in certain circles, certain areas of the world. You'll see this in some movies just on the wall. And I've always been intrigued because this fucking cat looks stupid and demonic.
Well, it's a very striking image.
It is. It's a very striking image. And I'm very excited to watch this because a friend of ours, Alicia, when she was over visiting the other day, I showed it to her and she's like, oh, I will watch this. I would watch this 100%. And we're going to let her and her husband borrow this afterwards because they're very into Japanese culture. Anime and all that stuff, so we'll see what they think of it, but I'm looking forward to seeing something completely different and dubbed. Honey, this is our third Japanese movie.
Oh yes, this one I've seen a little bit of, like, people talking about this one, and like I've actually seen some short clips from it and stuff. This is a very early attempt at visual effects in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, by today's standards, it is very shitty.
Is this horror?
Technically.
Okay.
But because of all the effects that they use and everything, and it's like a lot of compositing and a lot of things like that. It's laughable now.
But that's the beauty of these movies. You've got to go back to simpler times to see how far we have come. And it's one thing that I suffer from is the mentality of put yourself in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s when these first came out and how incredible they were at that moment.
I mean, I think the only movie that I really saw in theaters that was groundbreaking at the time was Jurassic Park. I saw that in theaters and how groundbreaking it was in that moment. But now, fucking Marvel limited TV series looks better than that now.
Yeah.
But you got to put yourself back in 93 when that came out and everybody was absolutely fucking gobsmacked. So I'm learning, guys, because I have a hard time putting myself there because a movie can suck to me because I have a 2022 mentality.
Yes. I think this one's going to be kind of fun to watch. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be interesting. I don't know if it'll be good.
Hey, we might. It might be the shittiest movie we've got to watch, but we might love it. We might hate it. We'll see in the review. Right?
But that brings our discussion today to an end. If you want to keep up on everything that we're doing, follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Grindhouse Podcast. We're on Twitter at Grindhouse Cast. Find us on Discord where you can chat with Leah about movies or whatever the hell you want.
Hey.
All the links for everything are going to be down in the show notes. Listen to us, give us a rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your morning fix. New episodes come out first thing every Monday morning. If you like what we're doing and you want to show us some support, you can find all that information down in the show notes as well. You can support us on our Patreon. We have support directly through Acast. Anything that you can give to help this podcast grow,
yes,
is much appreciated. Until next week, I'm Sean.
And I'm Leah.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.